session number 27347, Reel 5.
Stanley Band, Reel 5.
So Stanley, can you give me the background to how you came to join the Fleet Air Arm and why you joined the Fleet Air Arm?
Well, I'd fancied the Fleet Air Arm ever since 1938, when I heard that the Fleet Air Arm was going to break away from the RAF. I felt that there was something about being in the Navy and flying, that you'd always be fighting against other men. The thought of flying over an occupied territory and having to bomb installations where there were friendly people around it was bad enough, but even worse, in my opinion, was deliberately going to a town to bomb the civilian occupation to stop them working, like Dresden, because there was no real excuse for bombing Dresden except to kick them in the teeth for what they'd done to us. No, the thought of the Fleet Air Arm was, I'll always be facing men. I won't be facing any women or any children. This was reinforced before I joined up by a raid on Middlesbrough, where I was just coming away from night school on a bus, a double-decker bus, and a stick of six bombs dropped ahead of us. And I got off the bus and helped get some of the people out of the wreckage. And the lasting memory is of an ARP man who came out with a little girl, must have been three or four, in his arms. And he was saying that the bastards, the lousy, rotten bastards, and the tears were running down his face. And the thought of me causing that just sent the hackles down my spine. I couldn't have done it. I said this when I wrote my book, and I gave a copy of my book to a man who was in the RAF, and he felt that I was being very unfair and unjust, calling him child murderer. I wasn't. I was admiring him for having the guts to bring the war to an end quicker than it would have been. But I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have done it myself. The fact that he could was to his credit, I felt, because it brought the war to an end and saved an awful lot of lives.
But you felt, obviously, with the Fleet Air Arm, that it was a different type of war then?
Oh, yes, yes. And when I attacked somebody, hopefully, they weren't fighting with the hands tied behind the back. They could give me as good as I could give them. It was, I don't know, nothing's fair in war, but it was a more level playing field. It was them against us, us against them, and may the best man win.
Were you also interested in the Navy as well, really?
Yes, I was. I came from a family who'd had long connections with the Navy. The Brands originally were Norwegian seagoing people, and I don't know how many great goes back, but great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a Norwegian who came into Aberdeen and met a Scots girl and married her and settled down. I suppose she forbade him to go to sea again. Yes, the Brands were Norwegian. We have quite a history of seagoing people. One great-grandparent who at the age of 18 was second mate on a cargo vessel trading with the Baltic, and the skipper and the first mate were taken ill. We think it was sort of cholera or dysentery, something like that. And he brought the ship back when he was, I think it was 18 or 19. And yes, we have quite a few seagoing stories. I had an uncle who, after the last war, couldn't get a permanent job because of the slump, and he ended up running rum between Vancouver and Seattle until he was machine gunned by the coast guards, and my aunt made him give it up. there's quite a connection with the sea. And I had an uncle who in the First World War was in the Royal Naval Air Service as an observer. I had his helmet, and I never knew him, I never met him. But there was a lot of the Navy in me. My father was building engines for corvettes and frigates from before the war. Used to build them for whale catchers in the southern Antarctic. But yes, he was working all hours at Godsend with corvettes and frigates, and I used to watch newsreels of these things and admire them so much.
Because you yourself was in a reserved occupation, so how did you go about volunteering for the Navy?
I just went into the recruiting office and said, yes, I'm in a reserved occupation, but I want to volunteer for flying duties in the Fleet Air Arm. And they couldn't stop me. I must admit that the chief petty officer who was in charge of the naval side of the recruiting seemed to think that I'd got some young girl into trouble, or that I was running away from the police, that I should be so keen to get away. Anyway, that's all by the way.
When did you volunteer, Stanley?
On my 18th birthday, 11th of July, 1941. But then, of course, ICI were allowed to defer me, and I didn't get away until the 5th of October, 1942, because they were able to keep me.
And how did you hear that you were where you had to report to?
Oh, I think it was a telegram came to my home. I really don't remember. I got a notification either by post or by telegram to report down to Leon Soland.
And what was the reaction of your parents that you were finally going into the services?
My dad had been trying to persuade me to stick with the reserved occupation. He said, you're doing a better job there than you would be if you're in the forces. But I know that the night I went home and said, I've volunteered today, he went down to the Unionist Club and had a half pint of beer with his chums, and he said, you know what happened? My lad's been volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm today. He was proud as punch.
Where did you have to report to?
It was to Leon Soland, which was the Fleet Air Arm home base, as it were, down at Gosport.
How did you get down there?
Oh, I went down by train on my warrant, went diverted down to my grandmother, who lived outside Lewis in Sussex, because my Canadian cousin, whom I'd never met, was in the Canadian Army, and he'd just been brought over to Hampshire, and he was spending a 48-hour leave with my granny. So I went to Granny's and met my cousin, and he and I travelled back into Hampshire together at the end of the... I went down on the Saturday, had to report on the Sunday evening at Leon Soland. So my cousin and I went back through London into Hampshire on the Sunday evening.
And what did you do when you reported to Leon Soland? Were you met at the train, or did you report at the camp?
There was a bus at the Gosport Ferry, and it had a notice up for Leon Soland, because civilian buses were very irregular and unreliable at that time, and this was meeting all the Gosport ferries between about 5 o'clock and the last one, which I think was 10:30. So I arrived in Leon Soland quite hungry after something like a 6-hour train journey, and was met with great big thick corned beef sandwiches, which were like heaven, and stewed tea. Yes, it was my first introduction to navy tea that had been kept on a hot plate for 4 or 5 hours.
And who met you? Who met you when you arrived?
It was a stripey, as we called them, a man who had three stripes, or three badges, as we called them, for long service. If ever he'd had any rank of a leading seaman or petty officer, he'd lost it. He knew all the dodges, all the ropes, and introduced us to most of them.
And what was the thing after you'd been given something to eat? Were you shown to your accommodation?
Yes, the accommodation was in a Nissen hut, which had no heating except a pot-bellied stove for which there was no fuel. All the bedboards and broken chairs had been consumed in the pot-bellied stove. There was no fuel whatsoever for it. We were issued with two blankets, no sheets, no pillows. There were three biscuits on the bunk, biscuits we called them. They were about, square mattresses about 2'6" by 2'6" and about 3 inches thick. And there were three of those that we had on the bed. And the next thing I knew, I went out like a light. The next thing I knew was some crazy bloke with a bugle was going da dee da dee diddle diddle dee da, wakey wakey, rise and shine, the morning's fine, you've had your time.
What time was that?
You know, I can't place it exactly. If the following days were anything to go by, it was 6 o'clock. And of course, this meant going to the ablutions, which were a stone trough. It was about 10 feet long, and about 3 feet wide, and about 8 inches deep, with cold water, no hand basins, no plugs, cold water running. And everybody jostling for position. My father, who'd been through the First World War, had said, "You won't be able to get razor blades. Here's my cutthroat razor. take that, you'll find it's invaluable. You'll be able to shave when others can't. I had a position at the end of this trough, and people were jostling my elbow going past me. Yes, I remember that only too well. And the cold water, the scented soap which my grandmother had given me, seemed terribly out of place. Lifebuoy carbolic would have been more appropriate. Yes. Very Spartan. The lighting was very poor. The one or two mirrors, but they'd been so wetted over the years that the backing was peeling. There were only certain places you could see a reflection, if you could get near them. I did it all by feel. It was the only way.
And what happened next then, after you'd done your ablutions on that first morning?
We had to fall in with our gas masks and our bags. We had to pack all our personal belongings and take them on parade with us, because we were then marched off to have kit issued, and we had to hand in things like gas masks and so on. How the people guessed our sizes, I don't know. There wasn't a tape measure used, but the people looking at us had been doing it so long, they looked us up and down and gave us our kit. Then we had to try it on. Well, of course, it was a ratings uniform, which has bell-bottom trousers, a flap at the front, and then a jersey which was very, very tight around the chest. It had to be to accommodate everything that you had to add to it. Things like lanyards and Nelson's scarf. And we were shown how to fit these things to the uniform and to put them on, how to get on. And of course, I would have did have a jersey which was too small for me, and got it over my head with my arms in it and couldn't budge up or down, shouting for help. I wasn't alone either. The old hands knew all this, they expected it, they must have seen it dozens and dozens of times, and were there to help. They were very, very helpful. And having got a fit viewed uniform, we had to take it all off and mark the uniform with a wooden name plate made up out of alphabetical letters that were collected together with a piece of three-ply wood going down a slot in the back. And that finished name had to be wetted with paint. They had a baking tin with a piece of navy serge in it, on which white paint had been splashed, and you had to press your wooden nameplate on this inked serge or painted serge and mark all your kit with it, because in the Navy, any kit left lying about was collected up and went into the scran bag, from which you could only recover your belongings by payment of a forfeit. The forfeit was used in buying cleaning materials for the mess you were in. Soap, rags, scrubbing brushes, all that sort of thing. In the Navy, living conditions were always so tight that unless you were disciplined in looking after your belongings, the place would become a tip. So they were very, very keen that they would collect anything that was left lying about. We just had to keep ourselves systematic, and it was a good discipline.
You've been issued with a uniform. Were you issued with any equipment or hammocks or things like that?
Not at that stage, no. I was never issued with a hammock until coming back from Canada as a trained pilot, where we were given hammocks, and I'd never used one before. And of course we had the Canadian Army watching us. We had to pretend that we'd been using hammocks for years and years, and they thought we were just doing a Laurel and Hardy stunt when we'd jump up and tipple over and fall out the other side. Getting into and out of a hammock is a skilled job, and we weren't skilled at the Leon Solent stage.
So that day when you'd been issued your kit, had you had breakfast prior to that, or were you issued before breakfast?
I honestly don't remember, and I think it's because I hadn't much of an appetite for the breakfast. When the breakfast did come, whether it was before or after, I don't remember, but the porridge was a grey, glutinous, sticky mess, which had plenty of salt and no sugar. The milk was supposed to have been stirred in it while it was being manufactured, but I think it had all been given to the squadron cat. The consistency of that porridge is something I'll never forget. I don't remember what else we had. I think it was fried bread. I don't remember any bacon or any eggs. I think that was just too much to expect.
So what was the next stage after you'd been issued with your kit then? What did you do next?
To get fell in free thick. And then what is this keen gets fell in previous. In other words, no hanging about. And one of us was taken out by the scruff of the neck until you were in charge. Without any training, supposed to command them. Fortunately, my home guard experience came in useful. I'd been a lance corporal in the home guard. But I wasn't co-opted onto the job for about 3 days. But then I was glad I had some experience. The first day, the first man, he had no experience whatsoever, and my heart bled for him.
What was he supposed to do?
He was supposed to march us from one place to another, following on a small squad which was led by one of these stripers who knew where we were going, and we just followed on. And yes, we spent quite a bit of time being talked at that first day. I was there for a fortnight, and it was one of the longest fortnights I ever had, I think. I had boots that were too small for me. They were too narrow for me, and I couldn't get any wider ones. But I did a lot of square bashing that week. We learned how to salute. We learned all the bugle calls. for up spirits. We weren't entitled to any grog because we were under training, so there was no rum, no Navy run for us, but the whole place stopped for those who did qualify. We soon learned what the bugle call was for grog up, and the calls for meals, the calls for fall in on parade, divisions. Yes, we were given a lot of the Navy cult that day.
You said you were taught how to salute.
Yeah.
Is there a way of saluting then that you have to remember, a verbal way of describing how you're supposed to salute?
Oh, it's very different to the Home Guard or Army salute. Instead of having the palm of the hand outermost, as you do in the RAF and the Army, the palm of the hand had to keep in line with the forearm, as dead straight as possible. Very often you'll see naval personnel who have their hands bent at an angle to their forearm. The royal family are very guilty of this. No, the correct salute, the palm of the hand is dead in line with the forearm.
And the bugle calls, how many bugle calls did you have to memorize?
Oh, I couldn't say, but there was wakey wakey, get fell in, meals, grog. I suppose it'd be about 6 or 7.
What was your daily routine like then, obviously, after the first day when you'd been taught at and given you an introduction?
Lectures. I think the... and film shows too. They had a lot of instructions on film. And they also had all the morale boosters, like In Which We Serve, Wins Over the Navy, all that sort of thing, which were morale boosters. The cruel sea wasn't amongst them, but I think that was a little more frightening than the others. I think the one film that stayed in our minds more than any other was the one on venereal diseases. It was the first Technicolor film I'd ever seen. And if you do remember the early colour films, the colours were very garish, very outstanding. And to see close-up shots of venereal disease in accentuated colour was enough to put the fear of death in everybody. And fortunately, on our course, I think nearly everybody was a bull virgin, but we were so frightened by that film that we remained that way.
So was your day divided between lectures and drill then? Was that the kind of thing for that first...
That first fortnight between lectures and drill, yes. That's all it was.
Obviously you'd had experience in the Home Guard.
Yes.
And I take it that you took to drill fairly easily, but were there people who didn't?
It was all different. Yes, in every squad you get a man who puts his the wrong arm forward with the right leg. We had two or three of them who could never coordinate their arm swinging with their marching. They were soon weeded out and went not for flying but for naval duties. They were classed as being uncoordinated, and perhaps rightly so, I don't know.